This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9.
Thanks, Ben. Just before we kick off the show, we did just start off with Jenny Biddle, who was our guest in the studio last week. She was singing Freezing Time. She was ace last week in the studio. We've got another week full of studio and on-the-phone guests this week. Ben, it's been almost a month since the US state of Colorado was horrified when a gunman burst into a midnight movie screening of the new Batman movie. It opened fire on the audience and killed 12. That case has put America's attitude towards firearms back in the spotlight. We'll be joined by Clem Bastow, who's a writer for The Age and Daily Life, who's just returned from the US, was there when it happened, and we'll have a chat to her.
Against tobacco companies earlier in the week, with the High Court opening the doors on the plan. But will it work, and is it even right to take away the intellectual property of cigarette manufacturers? Quick Victoria will join us on the phone to give their take on what this new legislation is setting out to achieve.
Yep. A little bit later in the show, some more music. Susie Blue once saw herself as part of a large orchestra, playing her role in the creation of lush, beautiful sounds. Her passion hasn't changed, but she's ditched the orchestral dreams and she's blooming into a colourful solo creative artiste. She'll be joining us in the studio. She's even going to play for us.
And continuing the musical theme, this is something I'm quite excited about. You might have been lucky enough to hear the wonderful Rhonda Birchmore here on Joy 94.9 when she co-hosted alongside Wes Snelling a couple of weeks back. Well, I was lucky enough to pop along to her new show in which she explores the persona of one of the most striking and mysterious singers of the 1960s, Julie London. We'll cover that one a little bit later on. Now, of course, all throughout the morning, if you've got any questions for our guests or you'd just like to let us know what you think on any of the topics we're talking about, be sure to SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. But what better way to kick things off and get us in that Saturday morning mood than the smooth sounds of Adele? Here she is with that amazing Bob Dylan cover, Make You Feel My Love. You're listening to Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9. Your hosts this morning are Brett and Ben. How are you, Ben?
I'm doing very well, I think.
That's good. That's good. Miserable day outside, although a little bit of sun poking through. I'm hoping it improves for this afternoon because, of course, Joy has its big outside broadcast in conjunction with the AFL outside the MCG. That'll be coming up straight after today's Saturday Magazine show.
Quite exciting, that one, actually. We've got most of Joy down there for most of the day, it seems.
Yep, it's pumped. They've got some fantastic guests lined up, some AFL players. They'll be discussing homophobia in sport, particularly in relation to the AFL. So you can either, if you're not doing anything this afternoon, you can pop down there, give them some support, gather around, create a bit of a crowd. You might have some questions for the AFL representatives that they'll be speaking to.
Look, they've got some excellent guests lined up, so I'm sure they'd be more than willing to take a lot of questions.
For sure. And if you can't make it down, or if the rain slash hail scares you off, make sure you tune in. That's coming up straight after Saturday Magazine. We'll be here from 10 till 12.
Saturday Magazine, every week from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Saturday Magazine. It's 13 minutes past 10. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with us here at Joy during SatMag or any other time, you can SMS 0427 Joy 949. I'll get in trouble from programming director for saying zero. You can phone in on 1300 Joy 949, or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. Now, moving on to our guests for this morning. It's been more than a month since Americans woke up to news of a gunman breaking into a Colorado cinema and shooting 12 people and wounding dozens more. Now, Clem Bastow, who's a writer for The Age and Daily Life, was in the States at the time, and she joins us on the phone now. Are you there, Clem?
I am. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
not bad. On the tram, so I apologise.
That's okay. That's
odd noises.
That's an authentic Melbourne interview then, and we can prove it's live. So you're on the tram. You're obviously back in the country, but you were in the States at the time of the Colorado shooting?
I was, had tickets, like most people, to the opening day, like the dark night. Thanks, tram driver. And there was a genuine sense of unease going into it. They did have some police posted at the Los Angeles cinemas earlier in the morning before they realised it was probably a bit of an oversight.
Right, overkill.
But it was, it was a strange day, and a lot of media at the cinemas. When we came out, we kind of got corralled by a whole lot of local reporters saying, you know, do you think this is going to affect the opening weekend? And I gave them a piece of my mind.
yeah. Good to see where everyone's priorities are.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, look, I understand that just before the shooting, you were actually working on a piece yourself for The Age or Daily Life about America's gun culture.
Yeah, it was really interesting. We literally filed it hours before it happened. And we were talking about the tendency among Australian tourists to go to the States and pose with guns, go to shooting ranges, you know, touch guns, go to the gun show, which is a real thing. I think it's kind of the allure of the other because, you know, as we all know, since the buyback scheme in the 90s, most young Australians have actually not seen the guns.
Yeah. Otherwise,
you know, held one or shot one. But then, yeah, it was this kind of terrible timing where all of a sudden the kind of American gun culture was really in our face in a very big way the next morning.
Yeah. Were you one of those people? Did you go to a gun show?
I did go to a gun show. I went down south to visit some friends in Louisiana, and the gun show was on in Lafayette, and it seemed like an interesting way to immerse ourselves in gun culture. It was pretty full on.
Clem,
down there, you don't actually need a license or background check or anything. You just have to be of legal age. You can literally walk straight in and buy one.
Yeah, that aspect of the article you wrote actually really, really shocked me because, I mean, we all know America's attitude towards guns is the polar opposite to a lot of Australians, but I don't think many of us really consider that in America you can walk into a shop, even Walmart even, and walk out with a firearm without any checks or anything whatsoever.
In a lot of states, yeah, that's the case, and that was the case in Colorado as well.
So when you were over in the US, so you were there before this attack happened in Colorado, and of course you were there to see the tragedy unwind. Did you notice a lot of any change in people's attitudes towards America's gun culture? Because, I mean, it's obviously something we talk about a lot, but you get the feeling that America doesn't really see it that way within themselves.
I think, you know, there is a desire for change, but I think it will be a generation or more before anything happens because it's so ingrained and the kind of dedication to the Second Amendment, which itself is fairly outmoded these days.
Yeah.
I mean, that was put in place when there was a genuine possibility that the government would rise up and come and get you. And, you know, that's, there aren't any militias anymore.
Something I
think. So in that sense, it's kind of an outdated amendment. You know, I mean, the thing that you get when you live there is that you do understand people's desire to be able to defend themselves. The problem that I have, and that a lot of people do, and there were a few great pieces written in the aftermath of the Colorado shooting by Marines, actually, is why is there such easy access to assault rifles? You know, why can they buy Kalashnikovs in gun shops over the counter?
Yeah.
And I think that has kind of come to the fore a bit. So I don't think we'll see any major buyback schemes or any real, any real gun reform. But I think that people are starting to wonder why it's so easy. You know, why someone can buy 6,000 rounds of ammo without anything tweaking online, some sort of system going, maybe we should look into this.
Yeah, I noticed, I read soon, or like in the next couple of days after the shooting, that the sale of guns actually went up in Colorado and in a few other states, which, I mean, probably because we as you said, we've got a quite different culture here. I found quite kind of strange because I would have thought it would have been the opposite. Everybody would have suddenly been terrified of guns, but that wasn't the case.
No.
It's very strange. You're mentioning that, you know, people can go in and buy 6,000 rounds of ammo. Do you think there's a halfway step where, you know, they may be able to sort of put some controls on the purchase of, you know, AK-47s and, you know, those major assault weapons as opposed to the ones that you need just to defend yourself?
I think so. You know, like, the thing is, and this is what this Marines article said, if you're a deer hunter, then, you know, you need that particular rifle. If you're a turkey hunter, you need that sort of a gun. But I think there should be some kind of minimum, you know, minimal level of what do you need this assault rifle for? You know, why are you buying 6,000 rounds of ammo, sir? I mean, the problem is then, I guess, people who are really determined to use it for evil instead of good, in inverted commas, have probably got a ready-made story.
Yeah.
Like that. But you've got to wonder, you know, why are there not limits on how much you can buy in one transaction?
That's true. I mean, especially coming from our culture over here, it seems like a bizarre sort of, even a bizarre question to even ask. But I'm getting back more to the cultural aspect of it. When you were over there, I remember reading in your article that you said to your friend that if you lived here alone, you'd probably keep a rifle in your house as well. Is that something that really it changes your mind while you're there, but then when you come back to Australia and immerse yourself in our culture, you realize how that looks from an outside perspective?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, it's more I said that when I was down south, and, you know, if I was living on an isolated property, then yes, I probably would have a gun in the house. But it's more just because, you know, the thing in the States is that the person who breaks into your house probably has one as well.
Yeah, it becomes a bit of a...
And then the problem is that more often than not, people who carry a gun for self-defence and are mugs or whatever tend to be the ones that end up getting injured, not the mugger themselves.
Yeah, and usually with their own weapon, as I understand it. Yeah. I mean, it becomes a bit of a chicken and an egg thing, doesn't it? You need a gun because everybody else has one.
And, you know, and if you spend enough time in a red state where the gun laws are lax, it is so kind of every day that you know, I'm a rational person. There's no reason I need a gun or I even support the use of guns. But when you're in a place like that and you can just walk into Walmart, it just becomes this kind of mundane thing. Oh, I'll just go buy a gun, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, such and such has a gun, you know. My friend's brother-in-law has an AK-47, okay, you know.
If that's the culture...
It's a strange place.
If that's the culture there, what was the reaction when you told them about Australia's gun buyback schemes?
They're fascinated by it. It was really interesting because it came up a lot and it was mentioned, I think, in the New York Times op-ed the day after the shooting. And they really are very intrigued by it for the most part because there hasn't really been anything like that. I think there was a kind of small-scale one, possibly in Boston, somewhere like that, but it was voluntary. I think it ended up being, you know, like literally a couple of hundred guns got handed in. And they, most Americans who you talk to about it just can't kind of wrap their heads around it. And I mean, it was pretty amazing, really, even for us to think about it. You know, looking back, it's definitely one of the legacies of the Howard era, one of the better ones, which is a dedicated Labor voter. I find it, you know, I choke on the words, but, you know, it was an impressively quick response to that. And I think it did have a proven, you know, decrease in gun violence as a result of that.
So you mentioned that you bought a wooden handcrafted AK-47 pendant over there. Now
I had that before I left.
Oh, yeah. You had that before you left. But you wore that often when you're in Australia, but you didn't feel comfortable wearing it in America.
Well, the thing is, you know, here it's easy to talk about, like, emasculating gun culture by wearing something like that and turning it into a kind of object of ridicule in a way. But, yeah, I mean, when you're in a country where the person next to you might be carrying a concealed weapon, it kind of becomes a little bit more difficult to satirize.
Yeah, it becomes a reality rather than just an object of some fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, maybe now in the wake of some more obvious repercussions of the gun culture there, I think Australians will perhaps be less dazzled by it when you go over there. And but like I said in the article, I think in the end I don't think it's anything more sinister than the kind of the allure of the other, because, like I said, you know, there are people who've grown up here and they've never seen a gun. You know, I've never seen one, never held one. Most people are surprised to find that we do actually have shooting ranges here, for example, in Melbourne. And so I don't think it's anything more than that, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, this tragedy has certainly highlighted a, I suppose you could almost say, an insecurity within some Americans. It's kind of, I think from our perspective, it certainly brought up something that we're quite comfortable with. We don't like guns. We rejected them. And most of us seem to be quite happy with that.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's important to remember, and this has come up a lot, is that, you know, the equivalent of the Aurora shooting happens, you know, most weeks. In individual accidents with guns, in murders, in domestic violence throughout America. It's just that these major mass shootings are the ones that tend to grab the public's attention. But the unfortunate reality is it's just constantly happening.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost a fact of American life now. But, Clem, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate getting your insights into American gun culture. We'll certainly keep a close eye.
Thanks
very much. You're listening to Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9. We'll be back just after this.
QNN Community Network News. I'm Matthew Hepburn.
And I'm Nathan Partenza. South Australia is set to become the second Australian state to legalise same-sex marriage in defiance of the federal government. Premier Jay Weatherill says he'll support a Greens bill currently before state parliament, and both Labor and Liberal MPs will be allowed a conscience vote on the issue. The announcement came as thousands of protesters marched in cities across the country, calling on federal parliamentarians to deliver reform, and follows a similar announcement from Tasmanian Premier Lara Giddings. A new poll commissioned by Australian Marriage Equality found 61% of Tasmanians believe same-sex couples should be allowed to marry, and 54% believe the state should introduce its own marriage equality laws.
In Canberra, the ACT government is reintroducing legislation to allow civil unions after the Greens agreed to back a bill in the Territory's parliament this week. It'll be the second time the legislation is debated in the Capital Territory after it was first introduced in 2006 and quashed by the Howard federal government for breaching the Federal Marriage Act. Greens MP Shane Raddenberry says the legislation is just one step towards full marriage equality in Australia.
This is not the end of the road, and that's the way we need to see it. There are improvements in the legislation. We will support it because of that, but there's a long way to go on this campaign to get to full marriage equality.
Meantime, in Queensland, some 22 staff at Healthy Communities are being made redundant this week as the effects of the state government's decision to axe the organisation's funding hit home. While the cuts will mainly affect its sexual health program, the Gay and Lesbian Health Service will also be forced to close one of its three offices and remove its LGBT alcohol, tobacco and other drugs project worker. The redundancies come after the Queensland government pulled $2.5 million from the group in May, citing rising HIV diagnosis rates. Healthy Communities Director Paul Martin says some of the staff had been with the organisation for around 20 years.
The main reaction from everyone connected with Healthy Communities is those feelings of anger and powerlessness. We believe that the decision to withdraw all Queensland health funding are based on misinformation about the HIV epidemic in Queensland and Australia and misrepresentation of our organisation.
The organisation, which is best known for the controversial Rip and Roll campaign, will continue to deliver HIV prevention services for gay men through small amounts of reserve funding.
1 year down the track, and New York's historic Marriage Equality Act has been a welcome boost to the local economy, according to a new report. The report, commissioned by New York's Marketing and Tourism Agency, says gay and lesbian unions have brought in $259 million to the local economy in the last 12 months. That money includes couples splashing out on wedding parties at an average cost of $10,000 each, and guests who have spent up big, booking out 235,000 of New York's hotel rooms over the last 12 months. The report also revealed that more than 7,000 gay couples tied the knot in the Big Apple over the last year.
Briefly, in other news, gay favourites the Spice Girls have reunited for the first time in 4 years to headline the closing ceremony of the London Olympics. A gay couple in Arizona has successfully adopted 12 children from foster care after an arduous legal battle in the conservative state's legal system. An Australian Olympic trampolinist, Jai Wallace, has been inundated with support after coming out as HIV positive.
To QNN Sport, here's Tanya Lewis.
Openly gay British athlete Carl Hester helped his Olympic equestrian team win gold in the dressage this week. Outdiver Matthew Mitchum thought this would be his last Olympics due to ongoing injuries, but has decided he might switch to springboard diving after he failed to make the final of the 10-metre platform. And in the AFL, St Kilda's Stephen Milne has received a $3,000 fine for directing a homophobic remark at Collingwood's Harry O'Brien. O'Brien said he did not take offence to the comment, as he himself has used such language before. It's the second time Milne has been fined for using a gay slur on field. He has apologised and will be required to participate in an adult education program.
Thank you, Tanya. If there's a story out there you'd like to hear on QNN, then let us know. Email us on qnn@joy.org.au. That's QNN for this week. I'm Nathan Partenza.
And I'm Matthew Hepburn. We'll have more for you next time on Community Network News.
This has been a news and current affairs program from the Joy Studios in Melbourne. For more gay and lesbian content, please go to joy.org.au.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9. Your hosts this morning are Brett and Ben.
Thank you, Brett. Okay, well, we're moving right along now to the plain packaged cigarettes legislation. You might have heard about that earlier in the week. There was a victory in the High Court on Wednesday that opened the door for Australia to be the first country in the world to enforce plain packaging on cigarettes. British American Tobacco Australia said it was very disappointed in the court's decision and that the only winners would now be the people who sell illegal black market cigarettes. But elsewhere, the outcome was welcomed, with the UK, New Zealand and India all floating the possibility of following suit. Here to give us their impression of what the court victory might mean is Executive Director of Quit Victoria, Fiona Sharkey. Fiona, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now, the response from a lot of smokers I've noticed has been that it won't change their minds. But was this change really for them, or are we really trying to target more of the younger smokers, do you think?
You're exactly right. Look, all the evidence that we have around the effectiveness of plain packaging is largely going to be on preventing young people from being attracted to cigarettes and taking up smoking. So our research from the Cancer Council Victoria has shown us that adolescents and teenagers who see cigarettes packaged in the way they're going to be from the 1st of December would perceive that cigarettes packed in packs like that certainly don't look as attractive, but also they would perceive that cigarettes within them wouldn't taste as attractive, and people smoking cigarettes from packs like that wouldn't be as admirable or aspirational. So on those three counts, I've often said I've never met a smoker yet who would like their children or anyone else's children to start smoking, and if we can achieve that through this huge measure, it'll be a great step forward.
Most definitely. And one interesting aspect I found was in the media battle that we saw between cigarette companies and the government, the cigarette companies were quite quick to play down any effect that branding would have on their product. But that would seem to contradict the millions of dollars that they spend on their branding. Would you agree with that?
Yes, you're exactly right. I mean, the tobacco industry is just a mass of contradictions. They fought so valiantly and so hard with so much investment against the government. For the first time, we saw them last year spend multi-million dollars on television campaigns trying to convince the public that it wasn't going to work. And in our business, we say that when the tobacco industry screams that loudly, we know that we're onto a good thing. They know that their branding and the investment that they put into, as you say, into developing the attractiveness of their packs is because they know that they lure young smokers into the deadly habit.
After the decision the other day, a couple of tobacco companies did say that the fight wasn't over. If following the High Court decision, what's their next avenue for fighting this legislation?
I couldn't possibly guess what that might be, but what I do know is that the tobacco industry globally are very worried about this measure because, as you said, the world has been watching Australia, and there are countries who are seriously considering plain packaging. And so if other countries follow suit, and indeed huge population countries like India, like China, if they adopt plain packaging, it will be devastating for the tobacco industry. So we know that litigation litigations, fighting governments in court, is the new armoury for tobacco industry. They will use their deep pockets to fight governments, and we hope that there will be many other governments around the world like ours who will stand up and face them and stare them down.
Fiona, the step towards plain packaging is kind of the next step. I mean, I remember when I was younger, you know, there was still advertising in magazines and that was banned. And then,
yes,
you know, outdoor advertising was banned. Then we've recently had the you can't display them inside shops. You know, it's a plain cabinet that you can't see them in. Has there been a noticeable step down in the take-up of smoking with each of those phased steps?
Absolutely, and this is, I guess, the point that we make about plain packaging is it's such an out there reform. It is something that is really, really significant. And for 30 years, people have told us at Quit and the Cancer Council that, oh, that won't work or that won't stop smoking. And yet we have literally halved adult smoking rates in that period, from 1 in 3 adult smoking to now less than 1 in 7. So it absolutely is working. And we know the formula: keep the price of cigarettes high, keep anti-smoking television campaigns running to educate the public, and restrict the industry like these measures through plain packaging, and restrict where people can smoke to protect others from secondhand smoke. And it's a winning formula.
Following the decision, how long until this kicks in? When do we start or stop seeing patent packaging? When will people be buying cigarettes in plain packaging?
From the 1st of December this year.
Right. Now, there's also been some suggestion that this will only lead to an increase in black market cigarettes. Has Quit got a view on that?
Yes, that's another furphy that's being perpetuated by the tobacco industry. The tobacco industry is also spending lots and lots of money with high-profile accounting firms to develop reports which are totally unsubstantiated, saying that plain packaging is fueling illicit trade in tobacco. We know that that is completely untrue. Our own analysis, and using the government's data of illicit product that is seized, the number of people who admit to smoking unbranded tobacco is just so minuscule. If we believed what the tobacco industry said, we would literally see 1 in 6 cigarettes being smoked being bought out of a side lane, out of the boot of somebody's car, and that simply isn't happening.
Yeah, Fiona, one other interesting idea I saw recently was that now, obviously, cigarette advertising has been outlawed for quite a long time in Australia now, but with this latest reduction in cigarette exposure, the companies are likely going to become more creative in the way that they get their product out there. Do you fear that sort of thing with the advertising maybe taking on YouTube clips and maybe more amateur sorts of methods now?
That certainly is an avenue that's open to them, and it's going to be a challenging one because obviously the internet is global and, you know, you can't put territorial boundaries around it thus far, and certainly that will be what the tobacco industry will endeavour to do. I'm sure they are planning many such approaches as we speak, but we will certainly be there to face them in those challenges.
Well, it's been a good week for Quit then, I guess. We'll have to leave it there. Fiona, thank you very much for your time this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. We've been talking to Fiona Sharkey, the Executive Director of Quit Victoria. We've had an SMS in from one of our listeners who didn't leave their name, but they've said that a wonderful precedent has been set by the decision and it will protect future generations from a toxic substance. If you want to get in touch with us, you can SMS us on 0427 join 949 or phone us on 1300 join 949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au. You're listening to Saturday Magazine.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Saturday Magazine. Your hosts this morning are Brett, that's me, and Ben.
That's me.
That's him. Now, our next guest, who's joined us live in the studio, she's been described as an intoxicating cocktail of shadowy cabaret folk. Now, if that wasn't enough of a mixture, her sound has been described as a ragtag calamity of Irish music blessed with bluegrass vibes infused with the sly and the whimsy. Now, to make sense of that description, she's here. Her name is Susie Blue. Hi, Susie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. She's not blue. She's in bright green today.
She is in green today.
I am, yes.
Susie Greener doesn't quite wear
I know. I saw. I'm not consistent with that. But my the violinist in the band only wears blue. For the
really?
Past, yep, for the past 10 years, she's about, yep, she's only worn blue.
Is that inspired by honor of you?
No, unfortunately. But, you know, that does help that she's in the band, you know.
It does. Now, Susie, you've got a long musical history, but one that started off not as a solo artist.
No, well, kind of, solo flautist, actually. So,
For those who may not know, what is a flautist?
Oh, a flute player.
A flute player.
You know,
player.
Flute. So that was my first sort of, you know, what I wanted to be. I wanted to be in front of an orchestra playing concertos, which isn't, you know, the most promising career. Well, you know, there's not many jobs.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of my best mates is a flautist who plays in front of orchestras.
Wow.
But his music, I must say, I've seen him play, is a long way from the ragtag calamity of Irish music.
Who's that? Out of curiosity.
Greg Lee.
Great.
So how did you go from being a flautist to becoming a ragtag calamity Irish, pick any word to describe it?
Oh, gosh, I suppose it was a long journey, but I guess classical music wasn't really right for me, and especially because I wasn't, you know, if it didn't fit into orchestral playing.
It's because it's quite structured and you're more of a... Because I was listening to quite a bit of your music, and it seems to be quite free-spirited and whimsy.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantasy-like, whereas classical music, I imagine, would be quite structured. You're part of an orchestra, you have to play your part.
Definitely, and how the conductor wants it. And, that's not right for me. And it's very athletic and competitive and not very creative, you know, playing the same piece over and over again, which is actually what you do as a singer-songwriter. You play the same song over and over again. But at least you get to write it, you know, and arrange it. And so... Yeah, so I sort of, after being disheartened by classical music, I went on to like jazz and improv and then Latin music and then, I went to South America and I just kind of, that just opened me up to just other styles and like pop people and I think I just went from there.
So I was having a look at your video for Circus, I believe it's called.
Yeah.
That is quite an amazing video clip.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me about how that came about.
Well, so that was from a competition from Paper Deer and Motive Melbourne, who are I think now both defunct. I think I hope I didn't kill them both, but yeah, so they had a competition for a free film clip, like just all these creative people are freeing up their time and skills, you know, to make a film clip for some band who happened to be me. So everyone, we all worked together and collaborated on that. And,
it's quite it's an amazing clip, actually. When I was watching it, I couldn't help but think of some of Tim Burton's early work.
It was fantasy
yet slightly macabre. Was there some sort of sinister element? Was that intentional?
Yeah. Well, the song definitely is, because the song's about, short, you know, nutshell, it's sort of about how the human race is a bit doomed. So, you know,
it's
it has
positive uplifting
but, you know, and how Circus, you know, kind of has that, you know, that creepy kind of vibe.
They do freak a lot of people out.
Yeah, I'm scared of clowns because of it.
It's common.
It's because of it.
So I'm
glad that came across.
Excellent. Yes, it did creep me out. I was actually watching it at 12:30 and it was raiming outside, so perfect timing.
I mean, would you describe your music as having a macabre theme through it, or is it fairly broad?
It's generally, a lot of people say it's generally really happy, usually,
Well, it has a happy sound, but the lyrics are certainly, I mean, they're not lyrics to just fill some space. They've got quite a bit of meaning in there.
Oh, thank you. Sometimes I'm writing them on the way to a gig, filling in the space. No, but I do think about lyrics a lot, and sometimes they are a bit, and I like that kind of, is it juxtaposition, you know, of kind of happy music with sad lyrics.
Look, I always think that makes a great pop song too, is, you know, a great dance beat with really tragic heartbroken lyrics. Do you write your lyrics alone or do you collaborate?
I know, alone, yeah. I should collaborate.
Is that a deliberate choice or no one likes you?
Just
no one helps.
Yeah. That's it. I guess I haven't put it out there. I did a few sort of mentoring workshops this year with Monique Brumby and Shane O'Mara and Charles Jenkins.
Yeah.
And so that was like, you know, in those sort of situations, I collaborate on lyrics and I love that. I'm like, please help me. So, but yeah, I just haven't put it out there.
Yeah. And if people want to see you around town, where do you play regular gigs?
We're playing tonight.
Oh, really?
What a coincidence.
What a coinkydink.
Yeah. We're playing tonight at the Wesleyan.
Yeah.
And then the next gig after that is for the Darabin Music Feast and the Melbourne Fringe. They've sort of joined up.
Okay.
On the 21st of September. And that'll be a really nice gig. That'll be the Northcote Town Hall, and I'm collaborating with an artist who I've worked with a lot. So she's going to put in installations and projections of her images and stuff.
Great.
And,
fantastic. Yeah. Are you from Northcote then?
I'm from Brisbane, but when I first moved to Melbourne about 4 or 5 years ago, I lived in Northcote, and I love Northcote.
Yeah, I've been to the Wesleyan a couple of times. It's a beautiful venue.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, isn't it? I think it's an old church or something.
I think so, yeah. Where they do the, well, where you'll be performing, it's a beautiful room. It's always candlelit.
Got a fireplace.
Yes.
No excuses.
I think you need that tonight.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You must struggle with this weather coming from Brisbane.
I know. I've adapted. I'm getting there.
You get used to it.
Slowly. I still complain a lot.
Now, you've got a CD out?
I do. We released a CD, an album last year called Curly Girl.
So. Yeah. Yep. How's that been going for you?
I don't know. I think good. Sorry. Don't ask me.
Compiling an album is a mammoth effort.
Yeah.
How long did that take you?
It takes ages. You think, this will be done in a few months. Yeah, whatever. You know, and then it just drags on and on and on. And then by then, some of the songs are 4 years old, and you're like, oh, God, get about. So, yeah, it does take a while, I think, like a year. I mean, we started recording another album just recently, and I'm doing a lot of that myself now. So.
Right.
So now I'm more in control of that. Hopefully that won't take as long, but we'll see.
Yeah, so you're not signed to a label? This is all independent?
No, I've got a digital distribution people who do all that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You can tell how learned I am.
It's just there.
Yeah, I don't know. They put it on iTunes and all that, and I just sit back.
So you play keyboards on your album?
No, I actually had a keyboard player on the album, but now I play keys more now in the band. And,
so you play the keyboard, but you're also a flautist. Any other instruments?
Oh, I play saxophone really badly. Yeah.
That's a shame, because saxophone was always one of those instruments that everyone wanted to learn as a kid, because it was the cool.
Don't we miss the saxophone solo?
Yeah.
Gaga tried to bring it back.
She did try to bring it back. She failed. I appreciate that, actually. Yeah. No one really
I still love a good sax solo. Big long-haired rock kind of way. Yeah.
Well, we've got a sax player, but he doesn't have long hair. He doesn't really rock abs as such. Just, you know.
No Tina Turner-like solos.
No. It's more like, you know, folk on, like,
Timmy Capello. Sorry, I've gone off on a tangent. Right,
you don't really have the hair to do a Tina solo anyway.
No, sorry. No.
Oh, well, but look, if you do want to see Susie without her Tina Turner hair, you can catch her tonight at the Wesleyan.
That's right.
Yeah. What time's that all kicking off?
8:15, we're having a beautiful solo artist from Sydney come up just for this gig called Wartime Sweethearts. She's beautiful. And then one of my favourite Melbourne bands, Odiana. They're quirky kind of pop. They're fabulous. They'll be on at 9 and then we'll be on about 10.
Excellent.
That sounds fantastic.
And if you want to hear what Susie is all about, you can listen to our next track, which we will be going to. Susie, you've just selected this one.
I have, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Well, this is another kind of spooky, kind of creepy, circusy kind of vibe. This is based on Dr. Seuss's The Thidwick. Oh, God. Did I say that with a list? Thidwick Big-Hearted Moose. So it's kind of a creepy, childlike song.
Okay, we look
fantastic.
Forward to it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you,
Susie.
Having me.
Everyone, this is Susie Blue, and the song is called Moose Hooves.
Moose Hooves.
Your iron shoes are dragging yours down. You always thought they'd keep your feet safe from a touch in the ground. Never thought the day would come when you'd open your eyes and look into the eye of a sun. The eye of the sun. Well, you know you will, you know you might as well join the eye of the sun. They get a pest inside your head, now they dwell. Well, you know you will, you know you might as well
Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
It is Saturday Magazine. It's 2 minutes to 11 o'clock. We'll be having the news with the lovely Matt Thompson very soon. Just before those announcements, you heard from Susie Blue, who was our guest in the studio. That was a song called Moose Hooves.
Yes, it was actually quite a good song. I really enjoyed that.
We've had some great guests the last couple of weeks musically. So,
yeah, we have. We have. We've been really raising the bar, I think, when it comes to local Melbourne musicians.
Yep, I like it. So, yeah, and as she said, if you want to get along and check her out, she's playing tonight in Northcote.
The Wesleyan, beautiful venue, beautiful venue. And you can also order beautiful red wine while you sit beside an open fire with candlelit music.
I don't know if we should be encouraging the consumption of alcohol, but we'll be all for the...
Well, it's still before midday, so no, not yet. But, you know, once it clicks over midday...
Yeah, so it's a free-for-all then. Now, don't forget, coming up after Saturday Magazine today, we've got the Joy AFL joint broadcast.
See, Joy at
broadcast.
The G.
Joy at the G. Dean Beck and Jade Gulliver from Joy will be down there broadcasting outside the Ponsford stand, I think it is. So if you want to pop down there, they'll be discussing homophobia in sport and particularly in the AFL and what the AFL is doing about it, taking an initiative to try to stamp it out.
That's right. It's part of the AFL's attempts to open diversity within the AFL, stamping out homophobia. So that will be good. Now, of course, while we're on air this morning, make sure you let us know what you think. How are we doing? What do you think about the topics we're talking about?
But only say nice things. Don't point out any technical flaws or anything like that.
So. That's right. Yeah, we only get positive comments here because our panellist Callum is nice enough to delete all of the
We've got a filter going
ones.
On, so don't even bother if you're going to get the boots stuck
It could
in.
Explain why we've only had two messages this morning.
La, 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 la.
Yeah. From our friends. No, I'm lying. That's not true at all. Okay, so SMS is 0427JOY949 or email on air at joy.org.au. Now we're coming up to the news.
You've been listening to Saturday Magazine on Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9. You're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9.
You are indeed listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, taking you right up until midday where we will cross over to Joy at the G. Coming up in our second hour, though, we've got Community Roundup coming up next, but we'll also, after that, we'll be talking about the new Julie London show over at the Comedy Theatre. I was lucky enough to pop along to that. But first, we're going to take you to the sublime sounds of MGMT with a track from their second album, Congratulations.
Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9, right up until midday. We are lucky enough to be joined in the studio by this week's Joy 94.9 Communiteer. He is the facilitator of the Young and Gay Support Group at the Victorian AIDS Council, and his name is Dan Tang.
Hello.
Dan, how are you today?
Yeah, good. How are you guys?
Doing very well, thank you.
Thank you for braving this foul Melbourne weather to make your way in.
Oh, not a problem. I guess Melburnian true and true, and kind of just do
That's
with
right.
It.
Yeah, be prepared for the unexpected when it comes to talking about the skies. Now, first up, can you tell us a little bit about the youth project over at the Vic AIDS Council?
Yeah, absolutely. So the genesis of this program was probably began sometime in the 80s. The late 80s, actually, and it gave rise to, began as a result of a rise to the AIDS epidemic, and I guess the identification of HIV and AIDS in the mid 80s, and so the youth project began in the late 80s, and then formally changed its, I guess, identity to Young and Gay in the early 90s, and that's how it is today.
Right, so I suppose a common misconception might be that the AIDS Council only focuses on issues to do with HIV and AIDS, but that's not true, is it?
No, we generally take a holistic approach because we believe that in order to identify, I guess, to support young guys as in this program and other age groups as well, we need to not only consider the health, I guess, issues, but also like community issues, self-esteem, and also, I guess, like identifying internalised homophobia and such issues as that.
The Young and Gay program, it's been around for quite a while now, hasn't it? When did it first start?
Young and Gay late 80s, but more formally in the early 90s. I guess the script and the manuals and stuff have always developed dynamically.
Yeah, so yeah. So from its early days to now, what's its aim? What is the aim of the Young and Gay program?
I guess it's ideally to identify issues around, I guess, health promotion and the transmission of HIV, and also just for a general awareness, empowerment and engagement of, I guess, young participants.
Now, I would imagine with it starting in the 80s, that was kind of pre-internet days, and people, probably had a lot more trouble connecting with other gay guys in the community when they were coming out. So, has that become less of a focus of the group now, the social interaction part of it, or is there still a need for people to meet people?
Yeah, the question's been posed similarly before, I guess, the rise of other social networks, like your online applications, your online internet and so on. However, having a face-to-face, I guess, place where guys can get together, feel comfortable, talk about their issues, especially like there are not only... I guess the HIV message, but also the interaction between other guys. Like, it's hard to get a group of like 8 to 10 guys together if you go on the internet and then go out to IQ afterwards on a Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, that's true. So we should actually mention that the Young Gay Workshop, they are being held from the 23rd of August to the 27th of September every Thursday night for 6 weeks, 7 to 10pm at 6 Claremont Street in South Yarra. And to register for the workshop, you should contact the Youth Project at vicaids.asn.au. But thank you very much, Dan Tang, for coming into the studio to talk to us about that.
No problem.
Moving on from that, we should mention our other Joy 94.9 community Roundup nominees for today. Brett, do you want to take us to that?
Sure. I'll kick us off. We usually have a fantastic
theme. There it is.
And here it is.
There it is.
I thought we were going to have to do it without it, and people would have missed it. They'd
I know.
Have missed it. They'd have missed it as much as they miss me giving the apparent temperature on a Thursday morning. It's Joy 94.9 Community Roundup time. Yee-haw. Now, the Multicultural Support Group, if you identify as multicultural and LGBTIQ, good news, there's a social support group just for you. The Multicultural Social Support Group provides a lively and comfortable way for like-minded people to meet and greet in a safe place. They gather on the first Monday of each month in South Yarra. You can visit their website for more details. It's agmc.org.au.
Victoria's Anti-Violence Project is the peak LGBTIQ community organisation leading discussion on violence and its impacts within and against the community. They're volunteer-based and not-for-profit. In its 16th year of operation, they're also a member of the National LGBT Health Alliance. Dozens of people have participated in AVP activities. Would you like to assist or get involved? Then visit antiviolence.info.
Now, everyone, men and women, that's everyone listening, 18 plus, that might not be everyone, welcome to come along to Joy sponsor the Laird Hotel in Abbotsford on Sunday the 9th of September, where the second annual Northside Bazaar will be on from 3pm till late. From 3 o'clock, you can grab a bargain at the pre-loved leather and fetish market for those just discovering the fetish lifestyle. From 4:30, you can bid like crazy as celebrities such as Adam Richard, he is a celebrity, and Dolly Diamond, she is too. They will be auctioning sensational, mainly non-fetish items. What that is, I don't know. Check it out. For more details, you can click on the Northside Bazaar button, which is on the top of the Joy website, joy.org.au.
And the touring East Timorese choir, Coro Luiko, is taking part in song and performance exchanges with two local choirs. On Monday evening, August 20, the Young Timorese Choir meets and exchanges songs with the Brunswick Women's Choir at the West Brunswick Tennis Club, 425 Victoria Street, West Brunswick, at 7:30pm. Tickets are $20. For bookings, telephone 9417 1983. And next Thursday, August 23rd, Coro Luiko performs in a song swap concert with the Victorian Trade Union Choir at Trades Hall, corner of Victoria and Lygon Streets, at 6pm. Coro Lirico was formed and brought to Victoria for its current tour by Boat, by Boat. I learned how to say that earlier and now I've forgotten. Boat, Melbourne's community music organisation. It has been taking part in a series of concerts under the artistic direction of award-winning East Timorese singer Ego Lemos. The choir sings East Timorese songs in Tetum, one of the East Timorese languages, and has been winning acclaim with its stunning harmonies. That is Joy 94.9 Community Roundup for today. More after this.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are on Saturday Magazine. It's 17 minutes past 11. Your hosts this morning are Brett and Ben. Now, just before those announcements and community roundup, we were speaking to Dan Tang from the Young and Gay Support Group at the Victorian AIDS Council, just to give those contact details again if anyone's interested in participating in the next workshop, which kicks off on the 23rd of August, or you've got any other queries regarding that or anything else that VicAIDS does. You can email youthproject, all one word, at vicaids.asn.au, or you can give them a call on 9865 6700. Now, Ben Ryland, my co-host, you had a bit of a social event during the week, is that correct?
I did indeed. I was lucky enough to go along to the opening night of Rhonda Birchmore's new show all about Julie London. Now, if you're unaware of who Julie London is and you haven't heard any of her music before, then for goodness sake, you'd better get that rectified and listen to some of her music now. We've actually got one here ready to play. We've got Julie London's Cry Me a River. That is the name of the show that Rhonda Birchmore is starring in right now over at the Comedy Theatre. It is playing tonight at 3 o'clock. I think there's one at 3 o'clock. Let me just check that. No, there is one at 2 p.m. today and 8 o'clock tonight, and it's on at 3 o'clock tomorrow.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine. I'm Brett Sweeting and my co-host Ben Ryland went to see the Cry Me River World of Julie London show, who we just heard, earlier this week. Ben, how was it?
It was actually an amazing show. It was an interesting concept because it's not... Rhonda Birchmore is not playing Julie London, which, if you know what Julie London looks like, will come as a relief to you because she does not look anything like her at all. Rhonda Birchmore is very tall and has blazing red hair. Julie London was quite short and was a mousy brown or maybe light blondish sort of hair. So they're poles apart when it comes to looks, but when it comes to being a 60s sex siren laying about on a chase lounge with a brandy in one hand and a shotgun in the other, Rhonda Birchmore really kicks it off perfectly.
Now, you said they don't look alike, but Julie London's kind of renowned as a very kind of sultry, jazz, smoky singer. Rhonda Birchmore, a lot of people would think brassy, hey, it's Saturday, larger than life character. How did she transform herself?
Well, Rhonda was really giving a commentary of Julie's life all throughout the show. So it started out as Rhonda coming on stage, and she started out in the dark, and then the lights came on, and there was a stage with a chase lounge on one side, and then on to the other side there was most of the band, who is the LA Combo, and they supported her all throughout the act, but throughout the show, she was giving little anecdotes, sometimes during the music and then sometimes in between the music, of what was happening throughout Julie's life. And the interesting thing about Julie London is that while a lot of the singers that we know from that era, often we know them because they were either the undisputed jazz greats or because they lived a life of scandal, Julie London wasn't really considered a jazz great in the same realm as maybe Billie Holiday or Ella Fitzgerald. Nothing like that. Her music is... it's completely different. When you listen to it, it's very... I mean, you heard Cry Me River just then. It all sounds very cold and restrained and, you know, removed from this world, which is, I think, personally, that's why she's stuck around this long.
Yeah, for sure. Does Rhonda Birchmore sound like Julie London, or is she more invoking the spirit?
I'd say Rhonda's voice is far more smoky. I remember... the first time I ever saw Rhonda Birchmer on stage was when she was playing a revival of the show MAME. So she was in the, obviously in the lead role, originally made famous by Angela Lansbury of Murder, She Wrote fame. So anyone who knew
and
her late in her
knobs
career.
Bedknobs and Broomsticks. For the older listeners.
And of course the Manchurian Candidate for the even older listeners. Angela Lansbury played that role and she was very much known for that role. The role was almost, it was almost written for her. I believe it was originally written for Bea Arthur, but, B. Arthur ended up getting the supporting role. Anyway, I digress. Rhonda Birchmore as Mame was one of the most brilliant stage performances I saw, and it was almost as though that role was made for Rhonda. The character of Mame was meant to have big, crazy red hair. She was meant to be larger than life, and Rhonda's voice in that was very husky and smoky because she was playing a larger than life theatre star.
Yeah,
in Cry Me a River. She's not playing a larger-than-life character. She's not really playing so much a character at all. She's really trying to evoke the feeling of Julie London being on stage. So it's almost like it's the next best thing to seeing a Julie London concert without, of course, Julie London still being with us.
For sure. I think Julie London kind of sneaks under the radar a little bit. As you said, she's not known as one of the great jazz singers, but she often pops up on jazz compilation albums and things like that.
That's exactly right.
You know, maybe this Rhonda Birchmore will bring her a little more publicity and to a whole new audience, as they say.
Well, I certainly hope so, because when I first fell in love with Julie London, I hadn't even heard any of her music. I just walked into a CD store, saw her on the cover of the album and thought, my God, she looks fantastic. I'm buying it. So I did.
Do you know what? That can often lead to many a good purchase. Now, you mentioned the show is still playing.
It's still playing tonight and tomorrow. So there's one show tonight and there's two shows on tomorrow. So get on it, people.
Yeah, if anyone's interested, get along and check it out. You're listening to Saturday Magazine.
Saturday Magazine, every week from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9. It's 11:29. Your hosts this morning, Brett Sweeting and Ben Ryland.
Hello.
Now, we're heading into the last half an hour of Saturday Magazine. And coming up after today's show, we've got a very exciting event. We've got a live outside broadcast from the MCG. Now, technology permitting, we're joining now to our live broadcast down there. Have we got Dean Beck and Jade Gulliver?
Oh, look, it's an absolute delight to be with you. Thank you very much for crossing to us. I think we're with you, Jade.
Yes, we are. Brett, I can confirm that the apparent temperature down here is -3.
It's the perfect day for a footy match.
Excellent. I hope you're undercover.
Only just. It's a little damp, but certainly it hasn't dampened our spirits.
Yeah.
Okay.
The throng are arriving for a big match. Jade, who's playing today?
It's Essendon and Carlton. I'm all decked out in my Essendon gear.
I was just going to say, that will excite Jade.
Very much
yes.
a part of it.
Yeah.
Yes. Jade, football, sport, what's it mean to you?
It's really important to me. I love the AFL. I'm always going to games. I'm a member and my partner and I go every week. So it's a bonding thing for us.
And today, a bonding thing for you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get to
Don't
that a little later.
Dirty. Don't turn it dirty.
Today is all about respect and diversity, and the AFL have been educating the players and the greater community all about respect and diversity. Jade, this is a big step in the right direction for our community.
I definitely think it's a good step in the right direction, yes.
Well, we will be bringing you a whole host of amazing guests today. We'll have former players joining us discussing how they are educating the community and the players. We will have people from our community joining us. And we have an exclusive interview with Jai Wallace, the former silver medalist Olympic trampolinist, who will be joining us here at the MCG. He came out just last week as the first elite athlete in this country to come out publicly as being HIV positive. Jai, this is a huge thing for the gay and lesbian community.
Yes, definitely is, and everyone tune into that bit.
Indeed.
And Scotty Lucas is going to be here later. You know.
Oh, wow.
She's excited.
You wouldn't
it's
want
an
to
Essendon
miss that.
Player.
Yeah, I'm sure it means something. So join us here on Joy 94.9 from noon today as we broadcast live from the MCG. Thanks to the AFL. Back to you in the studio.
Okay, I hope the weather holds out for you guys. And, just a reminder, if anyone is listening and they want to pop down to the MCG, the guys are outside there. You can say hello. You can check out what they're talking about with their reps from the AFL and homophobia in sport. They might even take your questions and pass them on. So get on down, and if you can't, make sure you're tuned in from 12 until 2. In the meantime, though, we've still got half an hour of Saturday Magazine to go.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
You are listening to Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget, you can keep up to, you can keep us up to date with your thoughts all throughout today's show, 0427 Joy 949, or please do email us on air at joy.org.au. Now, we are joined by a very special guest in our studio this morning. His name is Keith Lawrence, and he is the co-programmer at the Israeli Film Festival, which is just about to kick off in Melbourne. Keith, how are you today?
I'm good. Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what can we expect in the program for this year's festival.
For those that, as a lot of people will undoubtedly be aware, it's the 9th festival, and over the last 8 years, and we're continuing that whole concept, basically, of presenting a diverse program of some of the best films from Israel over the last 12 months. And because of the multiculturalness of Israel, inevitably, you know, the program itself is diverse in subject, in issues that it's exploring, in language, etc., etc. So it's a real snapshot, if you like, of Israeli culture.
Right. So for those who may not be aware, Israel's film culture, I mean, it's not something that it would be at the forefront of people's minds here in Australia. What is the film culture like in Israel?
It's pretty big, actually. I mean, there's a lot of comparison because over the 9 years, we've built a relationship between the Israeli film industry and the Australian film industry. Because in some ways, it's okay, the sizes of the countries are very, very different. But in terms of the size of the industry, it's actually very similar. Israel produces around about 20, you know, between 15 and 20 feature films a year, as does Australia. There's a lot of first-time and second-time directors, writers working in Israel and Australia. So there's a real relationship that's developed between the two. And I think the one thing that Australians in the industry will always say is that in Israel, they attract something like 12 to 15% of box office income to their own films. Whereas in Australia, of course, it's struggling around 4-5%.
Yes, yes. So, notorious subject, that one.
Absolutely. So you can imagine that Israeli film is very much part of local culture. So therefore, it's there and thereabouts.
With the topic of Israel can sometimes fall into quite heated political discussion, especially here in Australia. How much does politics play in the Israeli Film Festival, and is it something you try to distance from it, or are you open arms to political topics?
It's open house. I think the question there is we're not afraid of programming warts and all, so it's not only showing the best of and the best of Israel in a good light, etc. It's not a marketing. I mean, it's that concept. Of course, maybe 9 years ago, political with a small p, you know, that concept of trying to introduce and educate Australian audiences in terms of what Israel's really about, rather than just the military, rather than just the politics. And so nowadays, it's, as I say, we're not afraid of screening films that are exploring politics. It's really dependent on what the filmmakers themselves at a given year are actually producing. I mean, people here may have seen films like Lebanon and Beaufort, which were both commercially released, which was very much about Israeli military in Lebanon in the 1980s. And both were very personal explorations of their experience in Lebanon and in the military in 1982. And it's, you know, they were pretty critical of Israel, of the military, the way things were done. And I think that's the issue. It depends on what's coming out of the country at that, you know, a given year that we include in the program.
Yeah. So in regards to the films you do include in the program, how much of that is about exploring Israel's culture and presenting that to the outside world, as opposed to just what is happening in the film world in Israel? I mean, for example, in Australia, we seem to go through certain fashions when it comes to Australian films. For a while, we had the Priscillas and the Muriels, and then after that, it got down to the very niche sort of films about
family,
oyster farmers and peach canners and,
Yeah, yeah.
Random topics like that. Is that something that plays on your mind when selecting films?
Nope.
For Nothing like that at all.
No, I mean, to be honest, I mean, for example, we've included this year in the programme, which is, you know, a fascinating and a beautiful, really, really gentle film called Melting Away, which is actually the first ever film made in Israel that's exploring transgender. And it's a film that's because of the, you know, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners know Tel Aviv, but Tel Aviv is one of the gayest cities.
They have become a bit of a gay tourist destination.
Extraordinary.
They were on the headlines recently with their gay pride parade. It certainly looked, well, they had better weather than Melbourne pride parade, that's for sure. So it looked a lot more fun.
It's full on. I mean, Tel Aviv is a full on city. The US, online votings and things like that. It's constantly voted the best city in Europe, which I think is quite funny considering it's not in Europe. Tel Aviv does market itself as more of a European city city than a Middle East city. And it's almost like it was inevitable that such a film as Melting Away would come out of Tel Aviv. I mean, there's plenty of films in terms of people like Eitan Fox and Tomar A. Heyman that have been making films about gay couples, about gay, you know, sexuality, etc. But this is the first that's very much about transgender.
Is there anything else in this year's festival in the LGBTIQ arena?
Yep. The film which I keep changing my mind, but I actually think there's one of two films that are my favourite. One is Invisible, but the second one is a film called Lipsticker, which is very much about an Israeli Arab Christian woman and a Palestinian Muslim woman who are very, very close friends when they're younger. There's no doubt about it. There's the Christian girl is very much in love with the Palestinian girl, young woman, and their relation. It's about their relationship. It's about what happens. It's about unrequited love. It's predominantly set 20 years later, so they're both sort of looking back, and it's that whole concept of how time fractures memory, and that in some ways you see some of the events of their childhood from two different perspectives, and how very different the Christian woman's perspective is to the Palestinian Muslim woman. But it's very much about it's very, very confronting.
Excellent.
And that's a thing that I think if you were talking about a genre,
yeah,
I think what was interesting watching the films this year, some of the films are quite, you know, pretty full on. And some of the films we didn't include, not because of the sexual content, but just we didn't feel that they were appropriate for they weren't good enough in some instances. But always I was quite shocked, you know, at the level of, and I'm used to Israel because it's not a country of that you know, worries about and I've just forgotten the word, it doesn't stop sexuality, it's not worried about etc. And so, but watching these films, I was just...
They put it right out there.
They put it right out there.
So if it weren't for this festival, it would be likely these sorts of films would never see an international audience.
Absolutely.
So yeah, do you see your role as quite important in showing a voice for Israeli film throughout the world?
Yeah, well, I think it's also the important thing is that, as I said before, when it first started, it was politics with a small p. I think now because the Israeli industry, film industry over the last 10 years, it wins awards every year, major awards, films pick them up. And I think in the same way that we've, you know, Palace presents the Italian Film Festival, it presents with the Alliance Française, it presents the French Film Festival, the German, the Russian, the Spanish. I think what's happening is that with the Israeli Film Festival, it's just that because the Israeli films are so good, that in itself is a justification to have the Israeli Film Festival sitting alongside the Italian Film Festival, sitting alongside the Russian Film Festival, which opens, you know, halfway through the Israeli Film Festival here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I think that's the point. And a lot of people wonder if there is a political motivation of Israeli film in, festival, but it's more about just that concept that it's about showing good film.
Yeah, we're very lucky in Melbourne to have so many multicultural film festivals, even if they do overlap. Now, the Israeli one kicks off on Tuesday, is that correct?
Yes, next Tuesday.
Yeah,
not this Tuesday, the week after.
Okay, the 28th, and it runs until...
The 6th of 15th of September.
Okay, fantastic. Now, do you have a website for people who want to check it out?
Yeah, we have all the details, which is www.palacecinemas.com.au. It'll give session times, all the synopses of the films, you can purchase tickets, etc., etc. So anything that I may have said, to know that you know, may spark some interest. You know, that's where they can see the information.
Excellent. And one last question, just quickly before we go. If they only see one film at this year's Israeli Film Festival, which one should it be?
Lipsticker.
Okay.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, people. get on to it. Thanks again for coming in. That was Keith Lawrence, who is the co-programmer at the Israeli Film Festival.
Thank you.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
We are back on Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9. Now we're joined in the studio by our tech expert, Mr. David Eccles. How are you today, David?
Wet.
Wet.
I think there's a lot way to describe it outside.
There's a lot of that going around. I think they're in for a fairly moist afternoon at our outside broadcast this afternoon.
I'd say so.
But spirits will rise above it.
Spirits will rise above it, and especially right now because we are about to talk all things tech. David, now I believe you are going to tell us a little bit about the Samsung Galaxy S3. Is that correct?
Yes. Regular listeners would know that I've been a BlackBerry user for quite a bit of time. Me and Mac have been trading BlackBerry blows for a while now. And what we're doing, what I did recently was after the last show, I went out and bought a Samsung Galaxy S3. So I've been an Android newbie now for about 2.5-3 weeks.
Oh, really? You hadn't used Android at all before?
Not at all. This is my first experience with the interface, and I must say it was a frustrating experience for the first couple of weeks. In the end, I've resorted to actually, for the tech, going to see another tech to work out how to drive the thing. I'm really impressed with a lot of things about the device, but there's some things that I think all Android users will experience, and that's the battery drain.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Tell me.
So one of the things we've got here with Android is that Android, also like the iOS, is running under an operating system called Unix, or Linux, a version of Unix. And basically what we're finding is that users, if they don't know how to end their apps or kill their apps, they run in the background. And as they're running in the background, even though you don't use them, they start draining down your battery supply. And one of the things that happens is that we launch multiple versions of the same app. We don't just relaunch the same app in terms of what happens at the underlying system. So you may have only checked your messages and email and maybe played one or two games and stuff and then thought you've closed it and switched to something else. When you relaunch it again, you actually relaunch a new version of that. So one of the things that you need to become very familiar with is holding down, well, at least on this Samsung Galaxy S3 device, is holding down the home key. And you get a choice to basically end task or end programs.
Right.
And then one of the other things you need to do is you've got a task manager. And if you on any Android device, if you find out how to get to that task manager and go to what's known as the RAM, random access memory, and then basically go clear all, you clear your memory cache, you're going to have a much better battery experience.
See, this is the interesting thing because, I mean, there are a lot of people now who are talking a lot about the switch to Android and it being a much more interesting phone experience and how it's got lots of different
it's great.
More things that you can do. You can customize in a lot more ways.
I think the thing that some Apple... I've got an iPad, I've got an iTouch, I've got a lot of Apple devices. Both my home computers are Apples. My work computers are a Windows device. I think one of the things that you can feel like when you're using Apple is you feel like you're in a gilded cage. You are limited. Everything's got to come in through iTunes, everything, or the App Store. Jailbreaking, the minute there's an iOS upgrade, your jailbreak's broken. There's a lot of things about Apple which are great and ease of use. There's no doubt about it as devices. But Android as a device is also there. I found it a much more enjoyable experience, actually, of late than actually using my iPad in terms of usability. And the other thing about it is it's a little bit more open, even though it's Google. We've got two, as I joked last time I was on air, we've got two forms of evil now. We can either have the Apple version of evil or the Google version of evil, but it's still going to be evil.
It's
a dilemma for us all. I don't think any of us would have envisioned a day where we wouldn't be having this conversation talking about Microsoft or Nokia. And now we wouldn't even think about Microsoft and Nokia as a phone device or even a tablet device or anything else like that. And I think, you know, a decade ago, anybody who didn't have a 5550 Nokia phone was pretty strange. I mean, 80% of the market was Nokia. We had, you know, a few other brands out there. One of the things that happens with, if you know the one, I think it's XTC, XL1, the HTC device is Australia's only 4G phone. There are a lot of 4G phones, so we need to talk about this. In the US, they use a different band for 4G comms than we do in Australia. They use 900 and 2100. And this is why Apple Australia got in trouble about the all brand new 4G iPad.
Oh, yes.
It is a 4G iPad, just not in an Australian network. The Australian network's built on the 1400 band. The iPad that's manufactured for the US market primarily is built on the 900 and 2100 market. The one thing about the HTC device is that it's built at the 1400 band, which is the band that all the Australian 4G networks are going to be built on. The big question is, And this is the debacle of the 4G network, is that there's no global standard for 4G where there was for 3G. So one of the things that happens with 4G in Australia at the moment is that if you do have a 4G device, and you can get it through Android tablets and the HTC phone, is that unless you're right smack bang in the middle of the CBD, you're going to be swapping in and out of searching for a 4G network, falling back to a 3G network, swapping back to a 4G network. And when that happens, that's going to cost you a bit of battery power. So that's one of the things you do. 4G is a bigger pipe. You've got a choice. You can either go fast and die young, or you can be slow and steady and win the race. If you want slow and longer battery life, then you should basically turn off your 4G search functionality and live on 3G like everybody else is with a mobile device.
Well, my partner actually had, up until last night actually, had a 4G phone. But the thing was that he was finding was that he had to turn the 4G functionality off just so he could get a normal day's worth of phone usage. And that's when you buy a 4G phone, it does not say 4G as long as you switch it on, but then switch it off so the phone can still actually stay alive.
So from a user experience, if you're toggling in and out between turning your device between the 3G network, the 4G network, remembering to kill all the apps that are running in the background, remembering to clear the RAM, as a user experience, it's not very good. The first 2 weeks I was on the Samsung until I actually spoke to another tech expert about it, I literally bought 3 batteries to get through a business day. I bought a battery, I had another battery sitting in the charger, and I had a third battery as a spare just in case, because I wasn't getting 4 hours out of my Galaxy S3 tab when I first started until I learned how to kill the background apps. And all I was using it for, basically, because it's primarily a business device, is email, SMS, phone calls. And I think one of the things we're going to have to do until we get a bigger, better 4G network and all the telcos catch up is that really I think we should all sit and wait for the 4G experience. I think we should all just hang around in 3G land until we can have a 4G network, at least in suburban, metropolitan, Melbourne, Sydney, etc. Because until that time happens, the devices are just going to be a giant drain on batteries and we're not going to have a good user experience. And at the end of the day, technology is supposed to make our lives easier, not
add extra problems.
Yep. Exactly right.
You heard it here first, listeners. Agree. Stay in 3G land.
Well, look, one of our listeners has just alerted us to the fact that there is a 4G Windows phone and that we should think Samsung. I don't know anything about that off the top of my head.
I think there is a 4G Windows phone, and I think one of the things we've got to watch is that we all think that Microsoft's been asleep at the wheel, but the Surface was a real surprise. The Surface that they announced, which is another tablet device explicitly targeted for business, there's rumours flying around about the price point for that, and it's going to be extraordinarily low. And that is primarily, I see a lot of people in my day job who are replacing a laptop with a tablet device. And I think still find themselves in their corporate network, still using a Windows laptop, still using Microsoft Office, still, I think 99.9% of the business world runs on Excel. So basically, a Windows device targeted for business apps with a business focus. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with Microsoft. We predicted the demise of Research in Motion, the makers of BlackBerry. I think that's pretty much come true. It's an interesting space to watch, but I think basically we've just got to sit tight and wait until all our network providers see the network providers build a 4G network and it's across all of metropolitan Melbourne, and then we should start looking at 4G targeted devices and give them a chance to get the battery and the background apps management and all that kind of stuff right.
Well, the interesting thing that you mentioned with the Microsoft Surface tablet, that's, as you say, targeting towards business, but without there being the phone to go with it and the online aspect of it as well. So, I mean, for instance, one thing I was really impressed by when I bought my, I've got a Samsung Galaxy Nexus, and I switched from an iPhone to that. It was the first time I'd ever used an Android device. And the one thing that really impressed me straight away was how I could put all of my contacts into my Gmail account. And whenever I update anything to do with my Google account, it's just magically on the phone. There's no plugging it in. There's no iTunes giving me the rude finger. It's just it's just there. It just works.
Yeah, it does. I mean, this is the thing. The whole thing about Apple is that everything has to go through the App Store or iTunes. And, you know, even with iCloud, it still has to go through the App Store and it still has to go through iTunes. It's a bit of a gilded cage experience. And people are starting to get a bit frustrated about that, to always be connected up to a Apple device or even a Windows device, but primarily an Apple device. That's what Apple want. They want to closed network. The problem with that, with a closed system, is if anything goes wrong, if a virus gets in there, if anything gets in there, it's going to be like a fire in a theatre. You know, there's going to be absolute mass panic if a virus, you know, if an app just, even one app gets through Apple's security method, which has a background virus or something, then the entire Apple environment's hosed. And it's not just for us here in Australia, it'll be worldwide.
Well, look, if an app manages to get through Apple's app walls, then, you know, maybe it deserves world domination. That's quite a feat. But David Eccles, thank you very much for joining us. We'll certainly be keeping an eye on all of those topics that you've mentioned, especially the Microsoft Surface tablet. You are on Saturday Magazine here on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, every Saturday from 10 until noon on Joy 94.9.
It is 4 minutes to 12 on Joy 94.9. We have come to the end of yet another Saturday Magazine. Ben Ryland, it's been an action-packed show as always.
It has been an action-packed show and always a pleasure with you, Brett Sweeting. We should thank all of our guests. We had Clem Busto from The Age and Daily Life, Fiona Sharkey from Quit Victoria, the beautiful Susie Blue, who is playing tonight at the Wesleyan in Northcote.
Get on down and check that out. Dan Tang from the Young and Gay Support Group at the Vic AIDS Council was in to tell us about Young and Gay. Our lovely Ben Ryland also gave us a bit of a rundown, but he's not really a guest. And
you can thank me anyway.
All right, then. Now, not forgetting Keith Lawrence, too, from the Israeli Film Festival, who was in giving us his tips on what we should see over the next couple of weeks when that's underway. And just before, David Eccles giving us a rundown on all things Android versus iPhone.
That is correct. You're on Saturday Magazine. Stay tuned for Joy at the G coming up next.
You've been listening to Saturday Magazine on Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.